May please the court, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, representing James Navarro, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I could.
Yellow light comes on, you'll have 5 minutes, and you can stop at that time if you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, this case involves two issues. It's a burglary misdemeanor assault case out of Jefferson County. And the first issue has to do with whether the trial court erred in failing to conduct a full conflict hearing and fully advise the defendant or fully inquire of the defendant as to the issues that had come up in his relationship with his court-appointed public defender. And the second issue has to do with whether the trial court erred in letting in some evidence of other bad acts. And there was an oral motion in limine made at the start of trial, and trial counsel kind of inartfully worded the motion and talked about a incident that happened at a park prior to the incident that happened in the motel room involving the victim. And there was actually two incidents at the park, one immediately before and one immediately after. But let me address these in order. Regarding the first issue, the defendant filed a pro se motion to dismiss his public defender, and I believe that was filed on December 20th of 2007, and it's in the record, page 14. And it was a five-page long document, and it listed a litany of specifications as to problems in his relationship. And there was no action taken on that motion. And about 10 weeks later, in March of 2008, I believe it was March 4th, Mr. Navarro wrote a follow-up letter to the district court judge. And I believe his mother may have written a letter as well, and that's in the record. But he mentions that he has problems with court-appointed counsel in the letter. The letter did not cover all the details that the pro se motion included. That was much more detailed. Eventually, the trial court did address the issues in the letter only. And it's our position that it was a very, very inadequate inquiry as to the issues that had come up between counsel and the defendant. And the people take the position that the letter basically summarized what was in the motion. It's our position that it did not. It did not include everything that was in the motion. It was incumbent upon the trial judge to make an adequate inquiry into the extent of the breakdown in the relationship. And the reason I say that is there were essentially four people in the courtroom. There was the deputy district attorney, who didn't have a dog in this fight and didn't really have an interest in the issues raised in the pro se motion. There was defense counsel, who was actually the target of some of the allegations in the pro se motion. There were allegations of ineffectiveness on the part of trial counsel. So he was really in no position to take up the defendant's cause on this motion. And you have the defendant, who had a 10th grade education and suffered from chronic alcoholism, and he was not able to act as a very articulate advocate for himself. So by default, it fell upon the trial judge to make an adequate inquiry into what the problem was and whether it warranted replacing the public defender with appointment of outside counsel. It's our position that that inquiry wasn't done. If there are no questions on that issue, I'll move on to the other issue.
Let me understand that in that motion, that there was no allegation of a conflict of interest, but there were allegations of maybe the words weren't used, but incompetence.
I think that's a fair way to summarize it, Your Honor.
And you're arguing that because it was an allegation of incompetence, if that were shown to be true, that he would have the right to dismiss his counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And
that's
that we needed position. A hearing to figure that out.
That's our position.
Okay, proceed.
With regard to the second issue, and as I mentioned earlier, the trial counsel basically talked about the prior incident at the park, and he was really concerned about keeping out any references to belligerent or combative conduct by Mr. Navarro while he was in the Branch Walker Park. And to that end, the judge did caution the prosecutor, or did instruct the prosecutor to caution his witnesses to avoid using those terms. And the first officer who testified, Officer Pacheco, I believe her name was, did refrain from using those terms. But the second officer, Officer Raymond Marion, did describe my client as condescending and belligerent, I believe, were the terms. And that's exactly what counsel wanted to keep out. And I understand the people's position is this was res gestae evidence, but it's our position it wasn't. In order for it to be res gestae evidence, it has to be linked in time and circumstances with the charged offense, or it has to be an integral and natural part of the crime that's charged, or it would have to be necessary to complete the story of the crime. And it's our position that that was not necessary. We had Sarah Chavez, the victim in this case, testify as to what happened in her motel room. And I think that was very clear, her testimony. She said this happened. What happened in the park had nothing to do with what happened in her motel room. The incident with Ms. Chavez did not start in the park. Ms. Chavez had nothing to do with whatever transpired in the park.
If the defendant had been seen in a grocery store right downstairs, would that not be relevant to show that he was in the vicinity?
That's correct, Your Honor. If identity was an issue, if opportunity was an issue, if there was any dispute that he was in the area, you're absolutely correct. That would be relevant.
Does the prosecution have to wait until you make a dispute about identity or opportunity? Can't they, in proving their case, simply, you know, we need to prove that this is the man who did it and we can show he was in the vicinity?
I think, Your Honor, if I recall correctly, trial counsel, defense counsel, conceded an opening statement that my client was in that motel room and that there may have been an assault that occurred. I think that was what he said, but it was not. I think he characterized Mr. Navarro as being too drunk to have committed the burglary, and he conceded that there may have been an assault. So I think that there was no dispute that Mr. Navarro was there. I think that the whole case hinged on the intoxication issue and whether that would have negated the felony burglary charges. If I recall correctly, trial counsel pretty much conceded the misdemeanor assault, and that puts Mr. Navarro in that room. So, you know, the fact that he was a few blocks away at this park really has, you know, is probative of nothing.
So, its probative value is extremely limited.
Extremely limited.
Okay, go ahead.
That's pretty much it as far as what I've got, unless there are any questions.
Weren't the officer's comments about the defendant being very condescending and fairly belligerent referring to her contact with the defendant after the burglary and during his arrest?
At the park. That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. But it was back at the park. It wasn't at the motel room.
But the way I recall, the court's order limiting the evidence was about limiting activity or statements made before the burglary rather than after the burglary.
I think you're correct there too, Your Honor, that trial counsel limited his request to prior. And like I said, it was poorly worded, the request, and he should have been requesting that testimony about everything at the park stay out. And, you know, I think that what he really wanted to do was keep out the characterization of Mr. Navarro as belligerent and combative. And like I said, it was poorly worded. If there are no other questions,
serve your remaining.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Carl Spedigue, registration number 39208, and I represent the people in this matter. I'd like to begin following suit with defense counsel here. The first issue regarding the defendant's claim that the district court erred in denying his motion to dismiss counsel and to appoint alternate counsel without first conducting a more in-depth hearing. I'd like to begin. Counsel seems to disregard the claim, but I understand that the defendant, first of all, when the district court began to inquire into the defendant's grievances with defense counsel, the defendant revealed his true motive almost right away. He actually interrupted the trial court and actually said that he thought that he would be appointed a private attorney if he succeeded in firing his public defender. So he verbally admitted in open court that he was stating that the whole purpose of, I guess he didn't say this verbatim, but I would say that he was basically given the impression, or he said that by firing his public defender, the district court would appoint a private attorney to represent him. Now, when the district court corrected him and told him, I'm sorry, but you've been grossly misinformed. That's not how this works. You don't simply get to pick and choose your appointed counsel. The defendant said, oh, well then I guess I'm going to keep my public defender. So at this point, I think that's pretty important because at this point the court has no further reason to really inquire very deeply into the defendant's various claims because he's already pretty much told the court the reason I'm doing this is because I believe, and I'm not saying he's doing this for any purpose, illicit purpose. I think he really genuinely believed I want private attorney, I want a private counsel, and to do that, I have to allege some sort of, you know, misconduct or you know, inabilities by my current public defender, and therefore that's what he did. Also, the defendant's grievances are not supported by the record. All the complaints raised by the defendant in his motions and the letters were insufficient to require dismissal. The fact that the defendant was claiming that Mr. Heineman's laziness, you know, at the same time that he was claiming this laziness, Mr. Heineman was actively filing motions. I believe on page 10 of my brief, I outline a number of motions filed by Mr. Heineman where he was giving all sorts of evidentiary motions as well as motions towards, for instance, there was a notice of affirmative defenses where the defendant claimed that the defendant was claiming that Mr. Heineman had failed to investigate or pursue any defenses on his behalf, and yet he had two various motions that were specifically notifying the court of various affirmative defenses that they were potentially going to present. Additionally, there was multiple discovery motions filed that rebutted the defendant's claim that Mr. Heineman had failed to properly investigate the facts of his case. There was also, as to the complete breakdown in communication claim, the defendant himself undermined his own allegations by attaching a letter to the court in which Mr. Heineman was actually communicating with him about the status of his case and what their strategy should be. So in addition to all of that, the court also said, okay, look, I understand this is what you were under the impression that if you could come up with some reason to dismiss your public defender, that you might be able to get private counsel. We can keep the door open. If you still want to raise some contention, you know, if you still have grievances with your attorney, we can come back and address this at a later date. However, the defendant notably never raised any issues again. Accordingly, based on the defendant's own admissions, it seems clear that this is a case where he was sort of manufacturing grievances for the purpose of seeking alternate counsel. He felt he would be better represented by private counsel. Excuse me. Such a preference is certainly not grounds for dismissal in the state of Colorado, and thus the district court had a reasonable basis, which is the reasonable basis for concluding that the attorney-client relationship was not so deteriorated that Mr. Heineman would have been unable to give effective assistance and properly denied the defendant's motion to dismiss. As to the defendant's second issue, he's claiming the district court erred in allowing evidence of an encounter that the defendant had with police that the defendant had with police about a half hour prior to the assault in a nearby park. So in making this claim, I think, Judge Hawthorne, you kind of hit the nail on the head. There was two separate incidents. So we had one that occurred a half hour before where there was an encounter with the defendant, and then one that happened almost immediately after the assault. He specifically challenges in the trial court the issue of what happened prior to the assault, not after. And that's basically what they're arguing in the opening brief, if I'm not mistaken. So I think it's kind of important to go through the facts of this a little bit. The prosecution's motion sought to introduce the evidence of the initial encounter, the half hour before the assault took place, because the prosecution felt it was relevant to show how the defendant got into the area, the defendant's demeanor just before the assault, and a physical description of the defendant. The defense objected promptly, arguing that it was irrelevant 404B evidence. So the district court held that it was relevant res geste, and it was not 404B because the defendant's physical description of the the physical proximity to the hotel, his intoxicated state, and his physical appearance were all relevant. Now, I understand that the defendant's position is, well, we conceded all those things, so why is it relevant now? I would say that it doesn't necessarily, as Judge Carparelli, I understand that you were saying, I don't think that it has to be in dispute for the defendant, or I'm sorry, for the prosecution to present evidence to give a complete picture, because what we're talking about here is res geste evidence, and the whole point of this is to give the jury a complete picture. Now, the picture that we're working with here is a complete random assault. This man walked into this woman's hotel room. She didn't know him. His family didn't know him. They had no connection whatsoever. He walked in and punched her in the face. And the issue is, why would he do, you know, there's no context for this behavior. There's no reason. The jury's confused, like, well, how did this happen? Why did this person come this, you know? So for the prosecution to kind of give context and to provide the full story of how this all kind of came about and materialized is important so that the jury has the context necessary to come to their own conclusions.
Do you think the jury would not understand the evidence without this?
I think they would, but it would be I don't think they would, because there is that issue of who is this random person that walks in. It's just a very foreign concept that somebody would just randomly walk into someone's, you know, room uninvited, unprovoked, you know, with any kind of interaction beforehand, without any placement, context, or factual, I guess, scenario placing him there, that it would be difficult for a jury to understand, you know, a jury of his peers to understand that it was something just that simple. He was just at the park, you know, very close by. He was heavily intoxicated at the time. He came because, you know, maybe he didn't know where he was. You know, there's all the various conclusions that they can draw from that information. And I think it all serves the purpose of providing the full and complete story, kind of the context for the jury to take. Furthermore, the testimony, excuse me, that was all regarding the testimony prior to the assault. So as to Officer Marion's testimony, which seems to be kind of the crux of the defendant's argument, specifically his statements as to his being belligerent, combative, and condescending. Again, as Judge Hawthorne kind of hit the nail on the head, that was never limited or restricted in any way. In fact, defense counsel and the trial court, when asked by the district court whether his objection extended to what had occurred after the fact, defense counsel admitted that it was clearly res geste evidence and that it was admissible because it all had to do with his apprehension. Excuse me. Thus, Officer Marion's testimony regarding the subsequent encounter was clearly admissible as well. So in conclusion, both Officer Pacheco's and Officer Marion's testimony was relevant and admissible as res geste, and the district court properly admitted the evidence. And so unless there are any other questions, the people would ask that this court affirm the district court's orders and the defendant's convictions. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Borquist.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two very quick points I wanted to make. First, regarding how it was that Mr. Navarro came to draft this, the pro se motion, and I think the record is clear that somebody in the Jeffco jail where he was being held in lieu of bond had mentioned to him that that's how you bring the issue before the court. I don't think it's really relevant how it was he got this idea in his head that this is how you bring the issue before the trial judge. He could have read it in a law library book. He could have seen it on a rerun of Boston Legal. He could have heard it from a fellow inmate, which apparently is how he learned that this is how you raise this issue with the trial court. You file a pro se motion setting forth what your problems are with counsel. So the fact that he heard it from another inmate isn't really significant. The other point I wanted to make was the people's contention that the incident at the park somehow explains to the jury how it is that this man came to be in this motel room. I think it's quite clear from Ms. Chavez's testimony and from Officer Pacheco's testimony how it is that this man came to be in this motel room. He was incredibly drunk and he didn't know where he was, and he wandered into this room by mistake and mistook Ms. Chavez for somebody else, and that's how the misdemeanor assault came to be. So those were the only two points I wanted to make in reply, unless there are any questions.
Mr. Borquez. Thank you, counsel. The case of People against Navarro is now submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course. That concludes our docket for this afternoon. And so Division 4 will now adjourn, and the bailiff should so announce.
All rise. Court will be in recess subject to call.